Ms. Holder.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming today and being so flexible related to all the changes that have been going on. I really appreciate your help with that. I did want to let you all know, I think I've talked to you all individually, but one of the things that Speaker Lockhart and I did prior to the end of the year in our term, so this was like on the 31st of December, that we both resigned from the commission and then I appointed Representative Chavez Howe, and Speaker Lockhart appointed Representative Becky Edwards to serve on the commission for the remaining of the time. And they're both very enthusiastic about that, so I am very glad that that will occur. There was some discussion about whether or not it would be a good idea to actually have the meeting today because of the memorial services that will be taking place. But I will tell you this with the fullest set of confidence that Speaker Lockhart would be intensely agitated if we did not, meet today for work that she considered to be so very important because of her. So, we had talked about doing flowers, Gail. That was very nice of you, had thought about something from the commission, so I appreciate that catch. And in her obituary, she had requested it through the family that donations be made to her scholarship fund through Utah Valley University. And so I'm going to pass an envelope around, and if you all are interested in doing that, I've got the information of where to write the check to so that you can get, it's a nonprofit foundation, so that you would be able to receive a tax deduction, thank you, from that. And then I will put them all together, contact UVU, and it will be a gift from the commission to her. So I will do that. Do we have a representative Edwards? She's probably over in the Capitol boardroom now too. Because I had missed when that went out. So related to the new members, that would be Representative Rebecca Chavez Howe and Representative Becky Edwards. Could we get a motion about our new chairs?
So moved.
Thank you.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So I would like to hand this over to you.
Okay.
And in the meantime, I'll work on this minutes to her.
Okay. Sounds good. So it looks like our first order of business after doing that is to approve the minutes. You didn't do that.
No.
Okay. So to approve the minutes from the last meeting, which should be. Are there any questions regarding what members remember from the meeting they would like to clarified, or do you feel that the minutes reflect what was discussed and what the action items are moving forward? If there are no questions, I'll take a motion to approve the minutes.
Move to approve these minutes.
Friday, December the 19th of the Wayne County Commission. All those in favor of adopting those minutes, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? All right, thank you. So, we're kind of the only new members then?
Yes.
Okay, I just wanted to come out to see somebody else. All righty, we just looked the new co-chairs. Okie dokie. Alrighty, so we have today a presentation from Ideal Utah, and Amy is going to be making that presentation.
Yeah, I was here. I apologize. I was in the other room as well. So.
Oh, okay. Thank you for validating my ability.
Totally planned.
Well, we had some work to do, so that worked out well. Do you feel like you're situated and comfortable to go ahead and get started?
Yeah. Okay. We didn't have any audio visual, is that right? Because I thought it's okay though. I can totally do it without. And then I'll just submit. Then I'll send you guys out an email so you can actually see some of the statistics that I brought. And do we have other? Okay, I will send them.
Senator, did you want to tee this up at all?
Sure. So, Amy Coombs visited with me a couple of weeks ago. She's in an interesting position. She works with the interior designers, and I guess in the early 90s, and she'll go into more detail with this, the architect lobby made it so that the interior designers had to work underneath them. They had to have an architect sign off on all of their designs, not just anything with structural changes, but really anything. And this has had, as she was describing this to me, I realized that this fits in with what our commission is looking at in looking for ways that women maybe are disadvantaged, looking for areas that we can improve. And I think that this opens up a window that maybe we haven't thought about before in how there are a lot of professions out there that have been disadvantaged, primarily professions with women, have been subjected to regulations that are potentially unfair and harm women's ability to make a living and have their businesses. So I told Amy that it would probably be a good idea to get on the agenda and explain to us a little bit about what this issue is. And I imagine that we can probably think of other occupations that primarily are inhabited by women that this sort of problem exists with. She is running legislation this year, but I don't necessarily want to deal with that because that's not what this commission is about, but I do want her to give us an overview of what the problem is.
Yeah, so, and you did a wonderful job, so thank you. And it is very, very true. It's about 90% of the interior design occupation is women. There are more men coming along, and when that happens, it gets a little bit louder. They start to form lobbies and coalitions. But I am the female lobbyist. I own my own firm as well. And I did bring with me two of the interior designers, one of them, Kay Christensen Englert, who was here before the Architects Practice Act went into place. And so her story is very, very compelling, and the reason why I got involved with it in the first place. Because I didn't realize how much something like that would impact them. And so to go into just a little bit of the detail, so in 1993, I believe, the practice that came out, they didn't offer any sort of stakeholder meetings with interior designers. They just kind of went ahead and did it. So that was interesting, but anyway, it went through. They had a great lobbyist, and what it did was is it created an issue where there's only one group of people who control everything, and one, meaning everything above 3,000 square feet in a commercial space is no longer something that Kay Christensen Englert can do on her own, and she needs to go and get an architect to stamp her drawings. Now, her drawings are her intellectual property. Those are her designs. She created them. And even if she goes and wins the client, she still has to go over and say, here, did I do a good job? So that's one issue. The second issue happens to be about education. And this is what I run into when I'm telling the story all the time. They think, and this happened to me yesterday. And so I was sitting with the architects board and the they're AIA, so they're trade association, and they said to me, they're not smart enough. And then he said, they are as dumb as drywall. And they knew I was there. And these are people who are in the industry, and this is the person who is a code official. And for me to sit there and listen to them constantly, because this is not like a new thing. He just was very brazen because he was very upset when he saw our bill and he saw the way that it gave them authority to be professional again. And so anyway, I wrote down his exact words because I'm anticipating that he'll be testifying against us at some point in time. But he's, again, the gatekeeper, because the code officials are really the gatekeepers. It's not the architects, though they want to say that they are. And we do get along with architects. We have, I mean, the industry in and of itself, they overlap. And so there's quite a bit of architects who support us as well. But really, the bottom line is they are educated. It's a combination of 6 years of experience. They have an examination. They have a degree, and then they do their internships. So they really have, you know, the essential things that are needed that should keep them at equal levels as everyone else. But they're constantly fighting. They're the only ones at the table when they come to sit at the table that isn't licensed. And so it's one of those things where they had their secretaries do the stuff for them. So when the Architectural Practice Act came out, they thought, well, we'll just have our secretaries, they can do it because it's just pillows and it's just paint. And that's not what professional interior designers do. They do some of that, but they also do code-based environment types of things. So they work with the American Disabilities Act. They are working with fire safety. They are also working with egress. So there's quite a bit of health, safety, welfare issues that are involved with what they do. And that's really kind of the crux of it. And I know that there are goals that the state has, in particular, to help with women in business and with being able to pump up the creativity section. Because I know we have a big tech sector with business, and you see those big headlines. But what you don't see are the creative industries and the small businesses that are getting completely, like, they can't compete at all because their hands are tied by the regulatory issues that are involved. So that's kind of the biggest message. And so I didn't know how much time I would still have. I don't want to take tons, but we can, if there are questions for me to clarify.
I think that's what would be helpful right now, because I'm already gotten some.
Yeah, I saw you writing. It's fabulous.
That's the way I work. I'm just constantly writing. I've got a couple that have percolated, and then please, if others have questions, let us know so that Amy can answer those. And I see that you've got people in the industry that are also there. So you mentioned, one thing I was wondering, do the architects take a commission off of the work that you do when they require that 30,000 or larger? I mean, since...
3,000. So it's 3,000. 3,000 square feet is not very large.
No, it's not.
Think about it. Like,
no, it's not. I live in a 3,800 square foot home.
Yeah, and I, you know, Kay can probably talk a little bit about
how does
that
work.
Well, as far as it wouldn't necessarily be a commission, but it would, in essence, be some sort of a fee, because if I'm doing my interior design project and I'm charging my client a design fee, and then I have to go to an architectural firm if it's over 3,000 square feet and say, please, will you review my drawings? I need a stamp for permitting with the city or the county, wherever the project is. And they're not going to just review my drawings. 90% of the time, they recreate them because now it's their liability. And it's their E&O insurance, not mine. And so they're recreating the drawings, and then they're their property versus mine to see the project through.
Right.
So it can be a little difficult there. On some projects, I can go to a structural engineer and have them, you know, take a look and review things if it's but I don't design anything or do anything to do a structure. That's beyond my scope. But so many times the structural engineer is involved in the project. But the review process and the stamp and seal with cities, counties is through the architect. So yes, my client is charged, you know, a duplicate fee in essence if they choose to work with an interior designer independent of an architectural firm. And it's a nice balance between the focus of an interior designer and the focus of an architect. We look at things different. You know, we look at things from the inside, where we spend most of our time, and design from the inside. And so it enhances a client's space if they are working with an interior designer. But at the same time, if a permit is needed, they're also penalized. So yes, there is a problem there.
And just a second really quick question.
Sure.
You mentioned code officials. So do the code officials have an issue with this, or do they really not care? As long as the work is done appropriately and they walk in the room and the egress is there and something's not in the way and things were put together safely, et cetera, et cetera.
If we take our drawings to the county, if we have the ability to receive a permit for them, they're fine with that.
Okay.
They just need the authority from the state to be able to do that, to accept our drawings as well, even in a non-structural setting, as well as an architect's drawings.
Okay, thank you.
So then they're fine.
Any other questions for Amy?
Could you just explain a little bit the training and the education that you have that you feel confident that you could stamp your own drawings for that large?
Do you want to go into that too? Since they're both NCIDQ certified, so yeah.
A professional qualified interior designer has typically a bachelor's degree in interior design, has practiced at least 2 years before sitting to pass the NCIDQ examinations, the National Council for Interior Design Qualification, and it's the national benchmark. It would be equivalent to anybody's board exams. And that would be the benchmark for a qualified designer. And to feel qualified. And then we have also continuing education units, so we're always able to stay cutting edge on what changes there are in the building code, what changes there are in fire and life safety, lighting, and so on, so that we're continually updated on the changes in our industry, because it is changing rapidly and always has.
So the legislation that you would propose would only be for licensed professionals to be able to do that? Because there are a lot of interior designers,
correct,
right, that
mm-hmm.
aren't licensed.
So,
we would not limit them.
Yeah, so what we're doing is we're literally taking the space that's the commercial space above 3,000 square feet, and we're saying if interior designers as a whole would like to practice in an already licensed space, they're able to get in and be licensed as well to work within the space, because they've determined that there are health, safety, welfare issues with the space, and so they need a litmus test on that as well.
When you're done.
I'm done.
So I mean, I just want to bring this back up to a little bit of a higher view here. Can you describe to us the effect that the Architectural Practice Act has had on your industry in the last 20 years?
One of the things that, from gathering testimony for when we went through our licensing review hearings, was that a lot of the architectural firms jumped in about 20 to 25% when they brought interior design in-house. And so if you think about them bringing interior design in-house, then you're thinking that percent is going away from the small businesses. As well as if you can't independently bid on projects above 2,000 square feet, if you look at the it's called non-residential permit value. That means there's about $1.1 billion. I should check on my thing. But every single month, every year, 2012, and I'll get it right when I look at it. So 2012, they literally lost out of it was $1.2 billion in 2012 that they could have bid on. So,
if I could follow up then.
Yeah.
So do you know, were there a lot of women that had their own firms that then couldn't survive on their own anymore?
Do you have a list of some of those?
yes.
Yeah.
There were many. You know, I survived, but went from, you know, an 8-person office to a 2 over the years, and changed a lot of the type of work I was doing. But there were a lot of independent, qualified professional interior designers, a lot of small business owners, primarily women, And there were, I don't know, there were firms even like Clark Leeming, again, Marlene Leeming, a woman-owned business from many years ago. Conant Design was a fairly large interior design firm led by Nan Conant, who hired a number of interior designers. Neither one of those firms exist. There were many who left the area because the scope of work had changed so much. I mean, previous to that, I was able to do work for the state of Utah and have contracts directly with DFCM. I did their lobby, okay? And after the change, why, I could no longer have an independent contract with the state of Utah. And even contracts that I had in conjunction with architectural firms to do the interior design separate from the architectural, even if my contract was with the architects, that all changed because they decided to keep that income stream in-house and hire interior designers in-house. But instead of hiring all the interior designers that existed in the marketplace, they chose to hire, well, I hate to say it, but I mean, one hired their secretary and said they can do it. I was on a plane to Steelcase to see product from that manufacturer, and she was on that flight, and she, you know, admitted that she was now their interior designer and then their secretary. I had architects calling me saying, because I was president of the American Society of the Interior Designers at the time here in Utah, and architects would call me and say, what do I do to start up an interior design division? I'd say, well, legally in the state of Utah, nothing.
So,
unfortunately. Yes.
Two really fast follow up questions.
Sure,
I have
absolutely.
Very short time.
I know we're short.
So, how do you have any data or any evidence that shows what this has done to actually your income? Maybe, you know, the average income of interior designers now versus then. And was there any safety issue? Was there a precursor to this that everyone was like, oh, wow, this is a real problem. We've got to do something about this. Or what was the reason behind the architectural practice?
It was just quietly done.
It was not a safety issue. It was more of a turf issue, maybe?
Absolutely. It was a
turf and a downturn in the economy, and this was a way to control the larger square footage of the design spaces, because to limit us to 3,000 square feet when before we could do, I mean, a whole floor of a tenant build-out in any office building, you know, when you've got your structure, you're going slab to slab, you know, your shell is there, you know.
So, I'm sorry, and one more thing, any other states that do what we do?
Oh, yes.
It's a common...
It's a very common thing,
right.
But nobody has the restriction of 3,000 square feet.
Okay.
Yeah, and I
no
do have a number of
except
firms
Utah has that restriction. So we are, you know, that was kind of an overarching, and you know, we would certainly like an exemption to that so that we could practice independently of an architectural firm.
Mm-hmm. And you also have all your students too. I mean, you've got state-run universities as well. So they're still coming out. They're thinking they're going to get a job. You've got all. We just spoke to them yesterday.
And they're leaving the state.
So,
yeah. I have a question. Yeah. Well, Rebecca Chavez, this is a very interesting issue, I think, and I'm grateful that you brought it to our attention. I'm just wondering, in the scope of the commission, what we are able to actually impact or how we can, if there's something that we could do to support this or...
Well, yes, Representative Smith.
Yeah.
Chair Smith, I mean, Commissioner
Former,
Commissioner
Smith. So, thank you all very much for taking your time to come up here today. And so, the way that I've translated this for the Public Policy Committee, it relates to questions of pockets of industry or of small business that might be dominated by women, and what sort of practices are used to support those areas of industry or to undercut them or swallow them or whatever. And I think that is the major public policy concern. So what I plan on doing is circling back with the Carrie and with the research team to see if we can find that out so we can make recommendations.
So it'll be a subcommittee action. I just don't want to see it hanging without any sort of follow-up.
Thank you for that. Yes. We will be tracking it, I don't think, to the good senator's point. I don't think that we've been set up to support individual particular bills on
that with that type of macro or micro level focus, but overall support policy strategies that do not do this.
Well, and I think in committee, in committee meetings, you know, if there are, if we do get wind of legislation or anything that would support our broader goals and agenda with this commission, it would be helpful to have testimony stating that. It would be helpful to have members of the commission come before the committees and talk about how this has a broader impact on women and the economy in general in Utah.
Absolutely, and to that end, the good senator sits on the committee, and so do others that relate to business and labor. So even if we had information that we could provide the senator that would help her ask questions, or even provide information to the committee, like, here's an externality. What I mean by that is, here's an unintended consequence of what you are doing to women and labor in this state, by the way. So that type of information would be really, really helpful, both from the women-owned business kind of focus, as well as overall from DWS.
I think that's an excellent idea. I would like to offline maybe connect with you, and if you could possibly prepare a summary of your micro-level data, and that might guide us on more of a macro approach to the analysis.
Good idea.
Correct. And I would just point out to you that one of the other policy things that is helpful is looking at the women's procurement program. And so there, I know that there are goals there where they're wanting to increase that up to 6% of small women-owned small businesses being able to go for government contracts. So that's maybe a policy area that you can look at as at a macro level that would work. So
and there are changes in federal contracting recently, which
yeah.
are good.
Yeah.
As far as I know, executive order to change that program to be sole source, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to compete against another company now.
Yeah.
You can, as long as acceptable, it can be.
Yeah, so that's what we want the interior designers to be able to be part of that as well. But the law prohibits us from doing that. So.
Well, thank you for bringing this to our attention, Senator and Amy and team, for your advocacy and your information. I think that this was, which is always helpful for us, is just to learn more. We just, there are so many things that we just don't know in terms of what's happening in industry and in enterprise, and we want to make sure that we're got our fingers on some of these issues, and I think that's a thread that we'll start pulling on in terms of not only this industry and profession, but others that may have been encountering similar journeys. So thank you.
For having
us. So before we move on to the next item on our agenda, which are the subcommittee updates, we do have something that's coming up, an opportunity that's associated with the U.S. Department of Labor. And Carrie, do you want to address this again?
A while back, you'll probably recall that Representative Selig had made a connection with the Women's Bureau from the Department of Labor. We've been speaking with several people, including one, Betty Locke, who is arranging within Secretary of Labor's visit to Utah a roundtable discussion with our commission. It's become high priority for the Secretary, and we would like to have everyone attend if possible. It's short notice, so we apologize. And I will get a very detailed email out to you very soon. It's going to occur on January 30th, which is a week from tomorrow, at 1 o'clock up here in the Capitol Complex. I'll get exact location for you. We have been asked to get a very specific number of attendees. So I would like you to not only, if you can, not only come yourselves, but find one key partner within your scope that would be relevant and could contribute to whatever conversation we may have. Representative Chavez-Hauck and I have a phone call with Betty Locke tomorrow, and I will hopefully get more information about how we should prepare for that roundtable. Once I have that information, I will send that along with logistics in an email. And if you can be very specific on attendance, tell me if you are going to come and if you have a partner who will be attending with you.
Yes, Commissioner.
So this is the 30th at 1?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Here. Okay. This is pretty exciting, actually, because they reached out to us. They called me based on media that was out in the region based on the formation of this committee. And so when I went to D.C. for some other reason, I met with them, walk in this room and expected just a one-on-one. There was an entire room of about 15 women in a conference call, bringing in about three more from the Department of Labor who do nothing but focus on women in industry. And they were very excited about what it is that we were doing here and promised attention and follow-up. And I smiled and thought that was nice, and now they're showing up. So that's pretty cool. That's cool. All of you all, I think, should be extraordinarily proud of your efforts because it's getting national attention.
Hope you can join us. We're trying to find it in a time that works for those of us that are going to be busy next week during one of our lunch hours, and so I'm hoping that that should work for you too.
Well, to fairness to the two chairs, the Department of Labor actually also said, hi, we'd like to work with you to schedule a meeting on this day between these times.
We'll make this work. We'll find a way to make it work. Okay, I want to jump into committee updates. We've got 20 minutes allocated, but I'm going to give you, we're going to take 10 for this because we do have Angela Oh with the Legislative Fiscal Analyst Office to give us some information and update regarding Utah Futures and some questions that the commission had in previous weeks on Utah Futures and how that might be utilized. So let's just take 10 minutes to talk about what the committee chairs, from each one of the committee chairs, if you just take a couple of minutes and bring us up to speed as what's been happening in your committees. Who wants to go first?
So I'm Heather Barnum, and I've been asked to help with the communications subcommittee. And I'll probably take 1 minute because we haven't met yet, but we did have our first meeting scheduled for the exact same time as our labor roundtable. So that would be great. So I know that at least a few of us at this table will be available at that time because we'll be rescheduling that meeting. But excited to have, it sounds weird, Jennifer, I can't even say it, Anne-Marie and Trina as part of that. And then we've also invited, as we were allowed to, as a subcommittee, which is great, we can extend our arm into more people who want to be part of this effort in the industry. I've extended invitations to communications professionals that I know at Rio Tinto Kennecott, who does a lot with STEM and really champions women, and a lot with the universities in women's issues. Also a communications professional at UDOT, who also does a lot with STEM, is one of my main focuses, and I think something from a policy standpoint that we can do a lot with. I also reached out, and I don't have someone identified yet, but they seem very interested at LDS Employment Services. The reason I thought them is just because a lot of the things that we talk about from a cultural standpoint in our state, they may be someone who could really give some insight, and then also looking for someone from a minority service organization. I think we need to have that.
I can give you some referrals.
Wonderful. Yeah, I'd love that. And then I would really like to get somebody, although I only know men at UVU or maybe Salt Lake Community, I'd like to target one of those institutions because they have a lot of technical trades too, and some of the underserved type industries for women.
Heather, I think it would be great if we could have more men involved in the committees or
I know
various efforts. And so if you, yeah, I don't think it. I
should
think
we
it would
help?
I think it would help the commission if we broadened it.
Great. Okay, I was under the impression we wanted to do that. And then I do have one of our subcommittee members here, Bethany Hyatt, who is with the Department of Workforce Services, and her and I have known each other for a long time, so I'm really excited to have her part of our group too, and she's an excellent communication professional. So as far as what our first agenda items will be as we move into the session, it's things like what you brought up today, Senator Henderson and Amy, just what can we do as we look to the session from a communication standpoint, what can we support? And then really starting to dive into what is our plan for the year.
May I just interject? I think it might be logical for us to, when we start feeling getting a better handle on the scope of Utah Futures, that might be something that we move over to the communications subcommittee. Potentially, I feel that that may be a grand tool for us to communicate our messages.
Okay.
So
great.
So the policy committee notes.
Yes, I can do that. So, and also on Heather, I've got some contacts over at LDS Work Services because we connected.
Jen and I connected, and I've been working with
them. With the unions.
Yeah. In fact, they just went on a tour last Friday, and Mark McClatchon, I have all of his information.
Great.
Just call me if that's
I only know men over there.
Well, I know the woman. I've been working
great.
With the man. Okay.
Yeah.
He's been sending
so
people to my office.
So that's great. Yeah, we can help
it was
that.
Good. We had a good relationship there.
That's Public Policy Committee, I currently sit on this, Dr. Robinson, and also the good senator. And by virtue of their public policy expertise, so does Representative Chavez Hauck and Representative Edwards at this time. Welcome to my subcommittee. So
we talk about women's autonomy a little bit.
We've been the big focus has been on Utah futures, trying to unpack that and figure out. From a public policy standpoint, where that's going to land and how we're going to support it. So that's been our focus right now.
And we'll have a little bit more on that in a few minutes.
Okay. So I'll
give
a quick update on research. The current committee members are Carrie, myself, and Bert Coulter, and Judy Barnett. And we have a couple of suggestions for additional subcommittee members, and we just want to seek the support of the full committee. I'm going to name a few, and then if others have ideas they'd like to add, we can talk through those. Susan Madsen from UVU, Pam Perlick from the University of Utah, Anne Marie Austin from Utah State University, Anna Bergevin, who works in my office and did a lot of work on that report we looked at last week, and then Natalie, help me,
Tarosian.
From Department of Workforce Services, who did a lot of work as well on that report we did. So those are the five additions we have that we'd like support on. And I don't know, Judy, we haven't had a chance to visit if you want.
I must have missed that email.
Oh, it's kind of been going between a few of us. Sorry.
Oh, because I totally missed that. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anybody else that we'd like, Anne?
No, I was particularly interested in including him.
Okay.
This is a very rich group. Additional.
Yeah.
Additions.
And I think they bring different expertise to this research group, and it also spreads out. We have USU represented, which is our land grant school, University of Utah, which is our research university, and then UVU. And I like that we spread out our expertise across the campuses. So. Anyone else?
Well, I would love to include someone from BYU also.
Give me an idea.
I have absolutely no idea.
Okay.
Yes, I do. Okay. Tina Dykes, D-Y-C-H-E-S. She is I think she's the Dean of Education.
Okay.
And I was talking, she's in my ward, I was talking to her a couple of weeks ago, and she was telling me that the leadership team in the education department are mostly women, and it's the first time ever in the history of BYU. So it would be nice to bring BYU along.
Thank you. So we'd like the support of the group for these. Sound good?
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for those recommendations and for the addition. That's great. It's
okay.
Going to be a great team. All of this is working. I like all of her. This is all just
I need to extend invitations to those folks, and then we'll look at getting a time for our committee.
And let's connect on that, because I've talked to Dr. Madsen, I've talked to Dr. Perlick, I've talked to Dr. Austin, but I'm happy to do an email connection,
thank
too.
You.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Great work, commissioners. Appreciate it. So the next item on our agenda is some additional information on Utah Futures. I know that this is an item that you have had as a discussion item in previous agenda, but left probably more questions than answers in some cases. And so what we've done is we've invited Angela O, who is the legislative fiscal analyst staffer that is was connected with the bill last year that established the steering committee, I believe.
the alliance between the statewide data analysis and Utah Futures. To bring us up to speed as to kind of what happened after the journey of the original executive order that established Utah Futures, kind of where the journey is and where we were finding some starting points, and have a dialogue, try to answer some of the questions that some of you may have on this. And this PowerPoint was sent to you last night. Hope you had a chance to at least take a quick gander at it. But if not, we'll have Angela. We've got a bit of time, so we can...
Okay, so do you want me to go through the PowerPoint or just kind of answer questions?
Did everybody get a chance to read it last night? Okay, let's go ahead and just go through that.
Okay, and I've got extra copies in case anyone didn't put theirs last night. Okay, so I guess the first thing... I guess there's been some confusion about Utah Futures versus Utah Data Alliance. And this last year, in the bill, Senator Stevenson and Representative Last, they kind of combined the two. And so just to point out, the Utah Data Alliance, they are more looking at children from K through 12 and then high school and then into the workforce. And that's kind of tracking a student's progress over time. Whereas Utah Futures is more the component for high school students and younger adults entering the workforce. And it's looking at, if I choose this major, what is my expected lifetime income? If I'm re-entering the workforce, is this something that, is this an area I'm interested in? Financially, can I make a living off of this? And so the Data Alliance is more of the reporting and the statistical side. And Utah Futures is more of the counseling and kind of the outreach that counselors use to help high school students guide their path into the future. That's kind of the first thing to point out is there's a very clear difference, and Senate Bill 34 last year combined the two, and I think that's where some confusion lies of what exactly is Utah Futures. And I know, Commissioner Steele, your biggest question was who owns Utah Futures?
Who's in charge?
Yes. And
that
so
was the question.
If you go to, it's going to be, sorry, the number's really small. It's going to be slide number 3. So right now, technically, no one owns Utah Futures. So there are a lot of partners, and the partners are listed. I won't go through those, but the original executive order kind of just listed partners, and there was no fiscal agent. There was no designated fiscal agent of saying, if we had the lump of money, who is going to pay all our bills? It's kind of just been a mashup of some has been paid from DWS, some has been paid from UGI, but there hasn't been one fiscal agent. So that was kind of the concern with the original executive order, and that order expired on May 31st of last year. And so I think this last year, there's been the most confusion of, does Utah Futures still exist, and who's in charge? And so the new executive order, it still has the same partners, and the steering committee, they will be meeting tomorrow to determine who the new fiscal agent will be. And my understanding is that it's going to be UEN, and
oh my gosh,
who?
I dreamt it.
UEN. So Utah Education Network.
Okay.
Oh, I thought you said highlighted.
So you believe that UEA?
UEN.
UEN.
Utah Education Network.
Okay.
And actually, I believe their name has changed to Utah Education and Telehealth Network.
Okay.
So
where is that?
So they're within the state government. They're on the Retirement and Independent Entities Committee. And they are housed up at the U.
But they interface with all the different levels.
Yes.
Both public ed and higher ed
and DTS.
And health, which mm-hmm. I thought was really great because if you've got people that want to move into that industry or that profession, yay.
Sorry. And so,
I'm so excited about it. But when I was looking at all of the different entities that belong in the steering committee, that's mm-hmm. the one that I just zeroed in
yeah.
on.
Well, and then just one point, UEN used to be on public education approves, mm-hmm. and then they moved to higher ed. And then people thought, well, they kind of serve both. And so they were speaking at both committees. And it, I guess, offended some people saying that they're kind of double dipping and they're getting twice the coverage, so they're going to get greater appropriations. And so it became kind of an issue. So UEN was moved to retirement where they were saying, well, they're kind of an independent entity and they serve so many different areas. Let's just move them. And so they thought that was a pretty good fit. And so far, it has been a good fit. And so with them being the fiscal agent, we kind of thought there was more independence.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing to point out is, I spoke with Ray Timothy, the director of UEN, and he pointed out that he had no problem being the fiscal agent. His only concern was that people understood that any appropriations that were
specifically for Utah Futures were not a part of their operating budget.
For UEN.
Yes, and so that way, if, for example, funding was not appropriated in fiscal year 15 as a supplemental or fiscal year 16, that they wouldn't be expected to pay it out of their operating budget. That was their only concern, and aside from that, he had no issue with being the fiscal agent. And so, yeah, that will be determined tomorrow in their steering committee. So the timing is a little off in today's meeting, but from what I've heard, no one has said any other fiscal agent than UEN.
Yes,
so it would be helpful for the Public Policy Committee, with representatives' blessings, is to have like some sort of account of what actually happens after that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were several, we did a huge deep dive on this committee about what it is that we wanted to see out of Utah Futures to make it the best tool possible.
Okay.
And then is that something that we would communicate to him? Will UEN be actually... So it's housing this. I would imagine they were in charge of content and all that kind of stuff.
Well, so in the executive order, there were some highlights of what the steering committee and Utah Futures should do. And so if you look at, it's going to be slide number 6. So the steering committee, they're required now to kind of provide, and I only listed some of the ones that I thought were most pertinent. But you can see that, kind of measure the effectiveness of the website, ongoing evaluation, long-term success for users. So within the executive order, and I can provide you a copy of that, but in the executive order, it has kind of very clear instruction of what Utah Futures and the steering committee is expected to do while this executive order is in place.
Okay. Is the steering, will this, even if it's when it's transferred to UEN, will the steering committee still have oversight over it?
Yes. So UEN will just be the fiscal agent, so they'll just handle the financial aspect. But the steering committee will still include all of the members, and those are listed on slide.
Five.
Yes.
Okay.
And so, yeah, the steering committee, that won't change. All of the members will still have kind of equal say as to what happens with Utah Futures. It's just UEN would be the overseer of the money and pay the bills.
Who's in charge of the steering committee? Who's my point person to call over there?
So tomorrow that's going to be established. Once,
okay.
I've been focusing more on the fiscal agent, but tomorrow they'll also appoint the chair,
uh-huh,
and they'll do the fiscal agent. And so I'm still waiting to hear who the chair will be.
Okay.
But then tomorrow, yeah, Tammy Pfeiffer, we've been in communication, and she's going to get me kind of the aftermath of what happens in the meeting, and I can relay that back to you.
Oh, okay, thank you. Because I feel like, I mean, to the committee, all the work that we did going through after the evaluation that we were shown through Tammy about specifics that we wanted to see. Some of those are on the executive order, and some are not. So we have an ability to impact it there. So I will be tracking at that. This is fabulous. Thank you.
Okay. And just one thing I wanted to point out. I know when we had spoken earlier, one thing that you guys wanted was kind of a funding history of Utah Futures. And because there's no fiscal agent, it was really hard to get. And I had been working with DWS to get on their piece what they had contributed and that aspect, but I was unable to get a final product, which I think kind of just proves the point of you need one fiscal agent, and you can't just have a mashup of different people trying to combine different pots of money. And so right now, if you look on the last slide of the presentation, right now it's in Workforce Services in the governor's recommendation, but he's got $1 million as a supplemental in 15, and in 16 he's got $1.4 million ongoing. And then speaking with the governor's office, they just did that because in their mind they kind of thought DWS was the pseudo-fiscal agent, even though on paper it's never happened. But in talking with the governor's office and with LFA, we've kind of agreed if the fiscal agent ends up being UEN and these appropriations are funded during the session, we have no problem just moving them over to the retirement. Yeah. And so there's no problem there. It's just right now they're showing up in the governor's office, or in Workforce Services, in the governor's office's kind of view. But LFA, we have no problem making that change and switching this funding over if it does, in fact, get funded this year.
Well, I think one reason why the governor has put this appropriation in, because there was so much discontent,
mm-hmm,
remember, in higher ed probes and also public,
like, nobody
ed.
Wanted to own it.
No one wanted to own it because it was totally unclear if they,
yeah,
were being effective at,
mm-hmm,
all. So there was a huge debate on should they even exist, right? Do they do anything? And this is
what you're seeing here is their last-ditch effort to make it work. And if it doesn't, I mean, if they don't do something substantive, and especially with this funding, then I completely foresee that this is gone.
Well, and right now, they are completely out of money. And so the website is operating very minimally. And right now, from my understanding, is DTS, so a vendor did some work for DTS, for Utah Futures. DTS is saying, well, we're not paying this bill. So they've kind of said, okay, DWS will pay the bill. DWS is saying, we're not paying the bill. And so right now, it's just, you've got outstanding invoices.
It's just been a huge mess. And one of the problems is it has potential to be a really great tool, but it's not being utilized by K-12. It's not really being utilized by the higher ed because they have their own things. Like, each institution has something like this within their own purview. And so this is really a great time, I guess, if this is important to us, to support and beef this up and sort of see it through.
Well, I think, and I will get a copy of this executive order out to everyone, but this executive order is much clearer and it has more defined kind of expectations. And so I think, not being a proponent for it, but if everything goes as planned in the executive order, I think you'll see more outcomes, where the first executive order was just kind of, here's the steering committee, you guys have at it. And now this executive order is very clear of what's expected, and hopefully that would give them more insight as to what everyone's expecting them to do this time around.
So it's right now it's falling under the DWS budget?
Yes.
So there's no way it's going to get funded if it stays there. Because I'm just being honest, in social services, there's no way we're going to fund this.
And that's exactly
there's absolutely no way that they'll fund something like this.
Where they say, we're not funding this. This isn't even an effective program, and it has nothing to do with DWS. I mean, that's what we'll have.
I'm just being honest right there. We have hundreds of people that come and testify with real serious need, not enough to say yes to everybody, and there's no way that this will get funded. No way.
And this is something where the retirement and independence, Their committee is really small. They've got UEN, Career Services, and Human Resource Management. And so if UEN becomes the fiscal agent, this is something that they can talk about in their budget, just kind of saying, this is an item that we would like funded, but we would only be the fiscal agent, and it would be separate from their kind of building block requests. And so they would have the authorization kind of to speak in that committee, and it would get prioritized on their list, which their list has like five items.
So plus, I think it's a better fit. Mm-hmm. When did UEN move from higher ed over to independent ed?
Just this last year. So, the 2014 general session was the first time they were on retirement. Mm-hmm. And then the year prior, they were on higher education. But then they spoke in three committees. And I think that's what upset people of. They thought they were getting more kind of play with legislators, and that wasn't fair because not everyone else got to do that. And so I think they spoke on higher ed, public ed, and IGG because of DTS. And so that upset people, and so they just moved into retirement. So it didn't look like they were getting more airtime.
Do you think that there's a possibility of it getting funded if it moves into UEN? Or is that still...
I don't know.
All I would say is I would agree with Senator Henderson is that if it comes over to social services, it's not going to survive. Mm-hmm. Period. It won't. We'll kill it.
There's just too much else. I think it's still a really big fight. It's even in retirement. When we heard these folks, both Utah Futures and UEN, when they presented in higher ed probes, there was a tremendous amount of scrutiny on their role. Was this an overlap with what currently existed with each of the institutions? And that would be, that conversation, I guess, would be a little bit different. Now they're kind of, they're seen as their own entity in retirement. But I think that, because they're not going to have that background and baggage and awareness that maybe Utah State has something just like this, and K-12 isn't actually using this as a tool, and they're private. I mean, the numbers of people that actually use this, like in a K-12 setting, is just astoundingly small, considering how helpful this could be. So
that is, we're not going to back to something that's being seen, at least from a higher ed standpoint, as being, oh, this is already up and running, it's has a great track record over a period of years. It's more like this has a lot of potential, and let's, you know, let's grow this really great product. That's what I think the mentality is a little bit. And so we just, we'll have to shepherd this. We'll have to just watch it.
So it's 9 o'clock. We need to move on to those of us that are going to be attending the speakers more. Angela, thank you so much for your work, especially the quick turnaround that I requested. If you would be so kind after tomorrow, given whatever the outcomes are of tomorrow's meeting, would you just do an executive summary of what was decided tomorrow?
I'll do that, and then I'll also tomorrow then provide you with the old executive summary and the new one.
Thank you so much.
That was very, very helpful. Okay. Thank you. This is the first time I think we've been able to get our arms around it. And thank you also for making accommodations in your own schedule to be able to come and talk to us, too.
Anything
the last
for
second.
You.
We're very, very appreciative of your hustle this morning. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So one thing we do have on the agenda is to schedule a next meeting, but I think we can do that through Doodle. Is that okay?
Do you have a timeline in mind? In two
how
months, in a month? And
how frequently do you use the meeting?
We're meeting once a month.
Okay.
Because of the short.
Okay.
Okay. Let's do this session is the only challenge for us.
We do have in the statute that we have to meet once during session.
Oh, okay. Well, then we're going to do that.
We do.
We'll
really early in the morning, really late at night.
Or like a Friday lunch hour or something like with maybe, I don't know.
Early in the session, I guess.
Okay.
We have a lunch hour.
Yeah.
If it's not Tuesday or Thursdays.
Yeah. Let's just throw some dates on. Yeah, Tuesdays and Thursdays are difficult during the lecture because of the conference.
You should invite the subcommittee first.
Yeah.
Do we have the
assistants? We have the
meeting
assistants.
Was everybody
so
in the meeting?
If they're on the commission.
Yeah.
Some of the subcommittee chairs.
I've got to be the executive director.
I don't know.
I was really inspired by the work of the editors.
Thank you.